Techie Talk time, folks, with State Representative Techie Chan of Quincy once again back on Beacon Hill this time, Techie.
Hey Joe, good morning. Actually, no, it's afternoon, right? It's noontime. We're one of our rare after 12 p.m. show starts. And yes, I am in my office today, as people probably somewhat familiar with the background. We have not moved things on the shelf yet, but we may again at some point because we like to alter the office decorations every so often. But yeah, I have some in-person meetings at the State House. I know it's December 10th, and you're all wondering that, if he doesn't work in December. Right. But believe it or not, we actually do. So a lot of folks are coming in to talk about bills for next year already, even though bill filing doesn't really start until after January 1st. But the requests by emails and phone calls for meetings have begun. And I'm intending to do as many of these things as I can before December 20th. I'm hoping that I can get a quiet period between the 20th and swearing in day on the 1st. That's what I'm hoping to accomplish, but we'll see how successful I am. I was very unsuccessful during Thanksgiving week. Let's put it that way.
And you really still don't know for sure, your committee assignment, right?
No, I do not. People do come in on the anticipation that I will still be chairman of the committee and hope to, move a public policy issue along, or some folks are interested in filing a bill and see if I'll be interested in doing that, of course, sponsoring a bill, even if I'm not the chairman. So it's kind of a real interesting time frame where it's not just special interest groups and lobbyists, but also people emailing in, because they don't there's no time like the beginning on bulk emails, right? Anytime you can bulk email, you do it. And people are trying to figure out, who could be helping and supportive next year. Now that the election's over, right? The newly elected folks, the 19 new reps, we'll also start getting calls once they get into the State House, into the bullpen is where we kind of put the newly electeds in until they get offices. But they're going to experience this actually quite more of a deluge starting in actually January 2nd. But yeah, I've been chair of this committee for 7 years. Doesn't mean that I will be chair again, but it doesn't hurt that if they have an issue they're interested in, even if I'm not the chair anymore, a person that has this subject matter expertise supporting a bill can be helpful for the individuals coming in to ask.
Yeah. Which I should we should mention, flags are flying at half staff today due to the passing of a longtime House member, right?
We already had Gloria Fox pass away. And she's passed away a few weeks back. Her family went a very private ceremony. She didn't want to do anything publicly. I do overlap with Gloria. She was wrapped was elected, I believe, in like 1981.
Think that sounds right, yeah.
It was early 80s. And the thing about Gloria was great was that she made no bones about who she was and what she's about. She wasn't shy to tell you. And there's something lovely about that because it's like you don't get any more authentic. But she also learned, she learned as times change. She taught other people in the building as times change. But I'm gonna miss people like Laurie and many others.
Yeah, absolutely. So I thought we should mention it today, just because the governor's declaration for the flags, the state flags at least, to come to half staff.
As you all may be aware, when government officials will be elected, formers or judges, more police officers or other notables, the governor has control over raising and lowering the flag at half staff in that time period. So sometimes, honestly, I don't know. I know it sounds strange, but I don't always know what's going on. Sometimes there is a half flag, and it's sometimes a judge that passed away that I didn't know who this judge was.
Right. No, I understand that. Right. There's so many officials for sure. But just being a colleague of yours, I thought we should mention it today for sure.
Unfortunately, this is part of the job too, right?
Especially when you've been there as long as you have, Jackie.
Well, it's as I like say, this is the first year. 2024 is the first year I can feel it in my bones, as I like to say. You can feel a bit more. When you see a lot, experience a lot, and you see a lot of people come and go in your life, and it's the reminiscing. I know it's December. It's like the reflection period for some reason our calendar and our brains. But I mean, I've gone through many thousands of people at this point. In this life, not just elected officials, but constituents, acquaintances, people around the world, people around the country. It gets into the thousands, and Those of you see me at public events at home, my eyes start to glaze. I'm going through the database in my head as I'm trying to figure out who's who and the names
Right.
through it. And it does get a little mentally overwhelming because your stuff just starts to blur.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. Speaking of at home, a couple of events over the weekend for veterans, which was nice, Pearl Harbor ceremony, and then the General's Park and Bridge tree lighting ceremonies, and more to come, the Wreaths Across America this coming Saturday. So it's really a whirlwind.
It is a whirlwind. Christine does a great job at Veteran Services to bring people together, and then does a really good job on not just very respectful ceremonies and events, but also time efficient. I have to say that very good at maximizing time and recognizing that people have busy days, but we can always spend time thinking veteran and veteran's family. And I was in the State House for Gold Star family tree lighting. I didn't do any social media posts on that. It was more of a come in, say hello, wish everyone's family well, and so forth. And sometimes you don't have to social media every single thing, right? I
That's
mean,
right. You were there for the people that are it was important to.
and that's essentially all I was really doing in the end. There was no need to glam it up like some folks. And I'm not being critical of other folks, but even in my world, I kind of pick and choose. I'm like, no, this is more of a family thing. We help this family out a little bit here and there, and just thank your family and them for their sacrifices. But also very importantly, it is the holidays, and I just want people to have a happy holiday as well. So I was doing some State House running around that day, and it was an opportunity to do this. And Saturday, actually, the Saturday I'll report back when I see you next. National Conference of State Legislators, Asian American Pacific Islander Hawaiian Caucus will be in town. So the executive team is in town. I have to host because I am the local elected. It's expected. And it's just being good, being just doing, you should just do it, right? I mean, you have to
The
come.
diplomatic thing, right? Yeah.
Yeah, visitors are coming. You're the host. You're the one expected to make this work. So, and they're going to come in and talk about the National Conference of State Legislators Conference on August 3rd to 5th, and the expectations they're looking for us with the Massachusetts delegation here in the caucus on things they need and things they wish they could have. And we'll figure out which ones, which column they can be. We can get this, but we cannot. And then it's going to be a long working meeting on Saturday. But yeah, I'd rather know about this in December than finding out in June.
It's true. Yes. Put it in the calendar now, right?
Exactly. So I'm working, it's still working, it's fine. But yeah, no, it's what else? Oh, Southwest School had their middle school bazaar also this past weekend. I stopped in and said hi to some folks. I think the Housenet tree lighting, that's right, was the Housenet tree lighting on this week past weekend too, the lobster trap tree lighting. If you on C Street in the neck, driving past the fire station tonight, you can see the lobster trap tree, which it's actually pretty cool.
It's
Once
neat. Yeah, it's neat.
yeah, it's actually pretty cool. Like I said in previous podcasts, I was very skeptical of this whole idea until I saw it and realized, this is actually pretty cool.
No, it's perfect for a seafaring community. Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah, I was half joking, like, don't get a small child trapped in there, but otherwise it's fine.
Didn't they have a crab on top of it last year as the star or something? I remember there was a unique topper to it.
Yeah, I was talking to Dave DeBono about that. It became a supply chain issue. They could only find a crab, so they just took
Okay.
the crab. It's like, understood. People forget it
We
wasn't that long ago. Supply chain involved things like ornaments and Christmas trees.
That's true. You have to make do with what you've got.
Yeah, close enough. There are crabs. I mean, I'm aware if you're fishing out in the bay, there are crabs, so it is not inaccurate.
That's right. So we started talking last week about all of the upheaval around the world with governments collapsing, and little did we know that Syria was next.
Well, yeah, Syria, that's a very troubled country. So that's a Middle Eastern country that borders Turkey. And I think she has a border with Iraq and Lebanon. It's a very actually geographically huge space when you look at it. And even when I was a teenager and when you were young, it was very well known as a place where they had terrorist training sites.
Yes.
All through the 80s into the 90s, the U.S. military has did targeted strikes. I think for 40 plus years now, the U.S. have done targeted strikes in Syria. That doesn't get a lot of news attention unless they hit something wrong. Targeting before they had Al Qaeda, they were terrorists before Al Qaeda, and now they have ISIS. So, it's always been a very troubled war-torn region. It's a lot of geopolitical components to it because it's inside the Turkish sphere of influence. Turkish is a NATO member. It's also in the Russian sphere of influence. It's also in the Iranian sphere of influence. In the U.S., the Brits, and the rest of the European powers does pay some attention to it, but doesn't actually directly get involved militarily, like boots on the ground trying to take over the country kind of thing. Unlike the Russians in particular. The Wagner Group, some of you may remember the Wagner Group that was involved in the invasion of Ukraine. It's the paramilitary outfit that Vladimir Putin hires, the mercenaries, the basic, really well-organized thugs with really good guns, a better term. They were basically hired by the Kremlin to be the enforcers for Assad in Syria. And they also have contracts in African nations, which Russia has an interest in. And they do the ugly stuff because they're not actually part of the Russian government.
I see.
So the Wagner Group basically fell apart when its leader tried to go from Ukraine to Moscow, almost impeded on what appeared to be an attempted coup. And then sometime later, you may remember he died in a fiery plane crash that the Russians claimed was a mechanical failure on the plane. And the Wagner Group was essentially disbanded by Vladimir Putin, and they had a choice of integrating into the military system as is, or be left in the cold. I'll leave you to interpret what that means, being left in the cold. So this also meant that he also dissolved all the ones in Africa and in Syria, which means you have this private mercenary company not there anymore, as they're absorbed into the Russian military. And since they're off the books, meaning they're not affiliated with any country, they could do the worst of the worst things to people. And Assad was using that.
Yeah, of course, now he's fled to Russia.
Well, big surprise, right? His choices were Russia or Iran. And really, there was those two. And, he's a demonstration of a dictator who had comfortably relied on foreign assistance on military and financial aid. And so-called living under the Cold War style umbrella, and it doesn't able to manage after that. And in case you're wondering, Syria is not a homogeneous country. You have Kurds, you have Sunnis, you have Sunnites, you have a lot of other smaller ethnic groups. You have a large Christian population in Aleppo. It is a very diverse religious and ethnic, culturally ethnic, as well as a religiously diverse country. So it is not homogeneous. So it's kind of one of the challenges of Syria. And Assad actually came from one of the other very smart ethnic minorities in Syria. So he was not a representation as an ethnic group, the majority of the country. Which also, as you can imagine, if you're a majority ethnic group, it doesn't sit well. But then again, he just starts killing people to the tune of 600,000 people with bombs and chemical weapons. And torture prisons, all that. Now that the rebels have taken down Assad, the Western media has got a chance to look at the prisons and the torture chambers that were there, and prisoners being taken out. It's Saddam Hussein style horror that's in Syria, and it's like I said, it's very complicated when you look at a map because it's a big space with a lot of different groups and. Who the big winners and losers, right? I mean, the Ukraine war clearly has taken its toll on the Russian sphere of influence. I'm already aware that their influence in Central Asia is not what it used to be, as well as in those areas like Chechnya, those countries, that zone, because of the amount of resources they have to dump Ukraine war. Iran is a country domestically that's having serious problems regarding inflation, unemployment. Civil stability is a problem. They've already had a death of a president and a lot of questions about who the next Ayatollah is going to be. So they have a lot of political and civil instability. The Hezbollah was the other big backer of Assad. Hezbollah is a paramilitary slash political organization inside Lebanon that pretty much does what it wants in Lebanon. Yeah, remember Lebanon, it's like two pieces. There's a Lebanese people in the parliament, which is more conventional-ish, I'm putting quotation conventional-ish because there's no conventional about this, but you have a basically a paramilitary political full-scale like group roaming around your country. That's the political entity and also like does what it wants outside the Lebanese people, and
Right.
that's Hezbollah. And they've always been proxies by Iran. So, those three groups, have been pretty badly battered as Israel has totally decapitated Hezbollah's leadership team, like this Zapfi just ripped the head off the snake, for lack of a better term. So their leadership is a complete disarray, and it's been shown that they can't maintain a system, no chain of command system makes sense. And Iran has expended too much already between the UTs shooting at ships at Red Sea, which is still doing, plus their proxy wars with Israel. And and then you got the Hezbollah and Iran, Russia problem. So Assad's allies in the region that provided military and financial aid are gone. And the rebels are not one group, they're a fractured group of folks. And also not the same ethnic group or the same religion, actually. They're all different groups that just hate Assad, who finally was able to get together under the common cause of, my enemy is your enemy, is my friend, not my friend.
Right.
And the question now, of course, is when you have this type of a rebellion group, and a lot of these different rebel groups control territory in Syria, can they form a coalition or a deal? So everyone can kind of move forward and get along in a country that's pretty much a disaster. I mean, it's a disastrous country right now. And,
Yeah, it's pretty stunning how quickly this evolved.
3 days.
Yeah.
It was lightning fast in 3 days how quickly these groups just able to just organize themselves well enough, probably months and months in planning. But they picked a moment and moved quick.
Yeah, it reminded me a lot of the attacks on the Kremlin when the communist regime came down.
Yeah, actually, one of the big factors of why the coverage machine went down was because no one was paying the military.
Right.
Same thing was happening in Syria. Soldiers weren't getting paid.
That's right. Yep. So there, it creates an opportunity or a vacuum, if you will, and then this is the result.
Oh, this is absolutely true. I mean, the rebels are fighting for the survival, the military's trying to survive to feed themselves. And it's kind of two different approaches. So if you're not being paid, why am I going to be here getting killed, right?
Right.
That's the difference, over there, compared to, a lot of other first world countries, which are much more committed to their nations. It's just a very different mentality. And but that's the reality of it. So we'll see if it stabilizes or destabilizes the region more, but the goal is to just keep it contained, and that's what they've been doing for decades, whatever's going on there. But those terrorist cells are still there, and the US launched like 70 plus airstrikes targeting those terrorist cells because Assad has no ability to stop any air raids. The Russians did some air attacks on the rebels to no end. The Russians have two military bases, which reports are trying to pull out. They have a military air base and they have a sea base. It's only a sea base they have access in that part of the world, and the military base gives them ability to get into Africa from Syria. So reports are that pulling out equipment now, on anticipation that the new government is not going to be allowing them to stay for free, because I'm pretty confident Assad let them stay for free.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So interesting. I don't assume the US has an embassy in Syria.
No, we do have about 900 troops in Syria for the exclusive purpose of taking down ISIS. I mean, that's literally their job is to just kill ISIS. But I mean, the question is whether the new president's going to do that, because Trump had pulled out of Iraq correctly. Trump had pulled people out of northern Syria that were supporting the Kurds, and it resulted in a massive Kurd massacre by Syria because of the U.S. withdrawal and the Turks. Turkey doesn't have a strong interest in having more refugees come to their border from the current location, which is right on the border of Turkey. So
Right.
Turkey has enormous interest in what happens because it's a neighbor. Massive instability in Syria bleeds into their zone of influence, namely their country. And it's, again, the dynamics are different, right, than migrant and immigration problems in the US. You have people that are literally being chemically bombed next door to you. We don't see that here. And so the people that
Right.
come to the borders may not be favored by your own population for different reasons. It becomes this real kind of political slash humanitarian slash military combination of problems for Erdogan in Turkey. But it's just, I'm going to tell you, Iran, Hezbollah, and Russia pretty much out of the picture in Syria for right now. Erdogan in Turkey is most likely going to move in to try to fill the power vacuum in Syria by being its, new best friend, so to speak.
Interesting.
And Turkey is a very fascinating country. If you look at its geography, its long history in the world, before it was even Turkey, right back to Ottoman Empire, and its role geopolitics in the EU in the world. And even now, you remind folks, I mean, they control access to the Black Sea. It's the reason the Russians can't get it out, because the treaties that were made gave Turkey exclusive rights to control the channel access between the Black Sea and the Mediterranean. So it's one of the reasons that Turkey's actually kind of a pivotal player, where they can kind of try to work both sides of the fence the best they can. So keeping more Russian ships out of Ukraine, reduces the ability for any kind of Russian naval assistance. But at the same time, though, I mean, Turkey is directly adjacent to Russia as well in terms of its border access and sharing of interests. So, he's also been a president there for a very long time, prime minister slash president. So there's a question about his, whether he has a, democratic dictatorship, so to speak.
Interesting.
Yeah, keep an eye out. Syria actually does affect us. I mean, a lot of our global stability in terms of terrorist attacks from foreign folks largely relies heavily on the U.S. getting to them before they get to us.
Right. Speaking of refugees and immigration, have you heard about how the new rules here in Massachusetts are with the emergency shelter system, how that's working out?
Well, they keep changing the system around a little bit here and there, keep tweaking it. So the short answer is that, the 10-day rule, well, actually the 5-day rule, proved a little bit too short. So they
Yeah,
extended
right.
it to a few
Especially
more.
now, right? It's getting cold out. So,
Yeah, I believe they extended it to 30 days. And then a no return policy. You come once the system, you can't come back again. And that's been adjusted because of things like domestic violence cases. So they got to tweak it here and there. In Quincy, ENC is no longer going to host the Migrant Welcome Center. Bay State Community Services is going to host it on their site. The biggest change, of course, is that there'll be no housing for
Right.
migrants. ENC will be completely shut down for people on campus at, by the end of May. But, it's already started winding down throughout the year. And the existing migrants at Eastern Nazarene College will be in the process of leaving. If they're not all gone, they will be gone by January 1st to another locale. And Chelsea and Quincy will remain a welcome center for Bay State Community Services. Bay State Community Services will not be impacted by this change. They have already been planning for a while in case there was need to move, but nobody is staying overnight at the Bay State Community Center. And they're basically going to be brought in, processed, medically examined. Obviously, if there's severe medical issues, they'll be sent to an urgent care center or a hospital. And then, they'll be placed somewhere else. I wish I could answer where, but it will not be in Quincy.
Right. Yeah, there's several sites around the state, but it's interesting to see if that has kind of stemmed the flow, I wonder, of immigrants coming to the state.
Well, we can always speculate about this, right? I mean, at some point, the Biden administration just basically stopped issuing visas, right? You had an initial deluge because for whatever reason, which they still can't explain to anybody. It just did a whole ton at one time, which created a deluge on everybody. And then, there's also, with a changing administration, this whole new fear about what's going to happen to illegal immigrants, and now he's attacking birthright citizenship. So that affects people like, me, right? I mean, I'm a son of immigrants. I was born in the U.S. I have birthright citizenship. He's made no distinction about the legal statuses of anybody.
Well, and it may affect his own son, his youngest son, too.
That's correct. So, I mean, he's pretty much just blurting out these console policies that you're all thinking, oh, there's like a birther conspiracy. No, they're talking about you. Everybody in this country has birthright citizenship. It doesn't matter whether you are here with parents that were legally here or not legally here. As a person who was born here, you get birthright citizenship. It's a unique 14th Amendment constitutional provision has been held up by the U.S. Supreme Court on multiple occasions.
Okay, so
You can't.
that would take an act of Congress to change, is that right?
You have to change the Constitution.
Right. Okay.
Unless the Supreme Court reverses course. But also be mindful that the Constitution mandates that the U.S. president cannot be born in a foreign soil.
Right.
Has to be a birthright citizenship to be a U.S. president.
Okay.
Okay, folks, this is one of the things they teach you in social studies that I don't know if they teach anymore, but one of the most interesting pieces of the Constitution is that the U.S. president cannot be foreign born, with a small caveat that in the founding of the country, everybody was technically foreign born
Oh,
because
well,
they
that's true.
was a British citizen. So there was a caveat in there that after you get past a certain number of years, I think it was 50, I think it was the number, that you must be a U.S. born citizen. Born in the United States, not born elsewhere and become a U.S. citizen. So you cannot be naturalized, which is why Arnold Schwarzenegger could be a governor of California, but could never be a U.S. president.
I
Another
see.
proposal of this, you could basically just revoke anyone's citizenship. I don't care what he says for conditions. He's basically saying you can revoke anybody's citizenship. And also, as a result, you're taking away the opportunity for people to actually be running for president because you're just going to take away their birthright citizenship.
Right, even though they were born in the United States,
Yeah, this is something I find fascinating because people think it's like, oh, it doesn't affect me. No, it's you. It's like everybody. And this is one of those things I find absolutely fascinating about this part of the conversation is that people don't think critically to the end, like, who is a birthright citizenship? That's pretty much everybody that's actually
Yeah,
born.
well, it would have, I mean, if my father was still alive, it would affect him because his father was born in Italy. So, yeah.
Well, it affects you too, even though you're three, four generations deep, because as long as you're born here, it doesn't matter, right? Your parents could have had you overseas. You would have to petition for naturalization.
Wow. Okay.
There's certain provisions for military personnel, which they teach in law school, which is really complicated.
I'm sure. Yeah.
But if you're born in a foreign military base, you're technically kind of in the U.S., but you're kind of not. It's kind
Oh, I
of,
see. Right. Okay.
yeah, it's kind of funky. Same thing if you marry a non-U.S. citizen outside the country, and then you get the dual citizenship issues. And like, for example, like Bruce Lee was a born naturalized was a born on soil citizen because he was born in the U.S. even though he spent his life in Hong Kong. So
Wow.
when he came back to the States to go to school and start his acting career, most people don't realize he actually was a U.S. citizen.
Yeah, it conjures up all kinds of questions. Like, what if you're born at sea or in the air? Or, I mean,
The air went through the sea when, yeah, don't ask me now. This is
yeah.
not going to be a law school horror show flashback. This was part of con law, constitutional law, and law school regarding citizenships and how citizenships are established. And it's not as straightforward as people think it is. I mean, there's very simple ones, right? You're in the U.S. borders, here you go, right? Or you're in U.S. controlled territory, okay. But yeah,
Like
ships,
Guam or something, right? Yeah.
or Puerto Rico, people
Puerto
forget.
Rico, yeah.
It's U.S. territory. But I mean, you're on ships and planes, it gets really funky really fast. And generally, it's jurisdiction of who controls the ship. So,
Oh, okay.
but it's a little more than just that. But yeah,
It's a
Yep.
Pandora's box. That's what it is.
The legal thing, you're talking to the wrong lawyer, is what I'm telling you. You're talking to the absolute wrong lawyer to go through the other nuances of, where you're born. Like, who was it? Was it a Rubio? Was technically born in Canada.
Oh, I didn't know that.
It was a Cruz. Where's Rubio? I'm trying to remember what it, one of them has like a quirky, birthright citizenship, but it was a quirky one because of military family.
Oh, interesting. I didn't know that. Okay.
Yeah, there's a few electeds in Congress that have some interesting birthright issues. It's not an issue in a bad way. I'm not saying it's bad at all. It's not a problem. But, they do have birthright citizenship rights, but it had some families that are like military families, and they were stationed outside of U.S. borders. So, there's all kinds of, as you can tell, you need to talk to like an immigration attorney to go through the details, but it's pretty complicated. I think
Yeah,
people
yeah.
identify a pretty complex issue.
Yeah, I can see that. My goodness. Yeah, let's not go down that road right now. Yeah,
No, but the short answer, you should all know it affects the concept of birthright does affect you. End of story. It's just that simple.
pay attention. Be paying attention. Yeah.
Oh, as I always say, just because it doesn't, people always say too often, it doesn't affect you. I'm like, yes, it does. You just have to think about it for half a second.
Right, exactly, yeah.
Come to that realization.
I know that the DCR commissioner was in Quincy not too long ago, Tacky.
Yeah, I was with the DCR commissioner with Senator Keenan and Bruce Ayers. I talk about DCR property issues. As you may be aware, I have a lot of maintenance issues that I've been working on for quite some time. The biggest priority for me, I know there's a lot of priorities in the DCR properties, the street lights and Crespo Parkway. Street lights and Crespo Parkway is actually controlled by National Grid, not by the state. There is a process of transferring those street lights to DCR. From National Grid, which is an ongoing process, which I was told about 2 years ago, and I'm still waiting. The administration at the very end just said stuff to me, and I don't know what happened from there. So Commissioner Rigo, got a tour down first, both Balsam Beach, and down to the Bernazzi School. We walked the sidewalks. We looked at some railing problems at Ferrisbrook. We looked at the street light missing. We talked about the fact National Grid's underground cable project just actually destroyed a relatively newly paved Ferrisbrook Parkway. It's like a mess. It's good to have the commission come by and take a look. And the only drawback was it was raining. So we couldn't get a good view of the bay or the opposite side of low tide, where you can still see kind of sandbars all the way deep up and there's a lack of dredging. So
Right.
pointed out to him. And then, there's some graffiti. We just walked across it.
Oh, was there really? Oh.
There's always a little bit of graffiti here and there.
Yeah.
And then there's also a street sign that was down, coincidentally, was standing next to one. It's just one of those no parking signs was already on the ground. So, I mean, the commission is great. It's not a big, well, no, I'm sorry, let me rephrase that. It's a real big job that people don't realize how big it is because, yes, all the properties from the Quavon Reservoir to Revere, Nantasket, and all the passive parks to Taunton, Miles Standish. So it is a huge geographic territory. He services tens of millions of people a year at the DCR properties. Some are passive, some are active, but they're from, swimming pools to a giant reservoir, right? And it's a lot of land that he has to oversee and customer service issues. And the maintenance stuff, and one of the challenges he has is that his capital budget isn't like the Department of Transportation.
Right.
So he's working very hard to try to figure out how to prioritize his capital budget. And we ask for things like, do you have a schedule for sanding? And you may be aware the beaches inside Quincy Bay are not naturally recreational beaches. Those beach sand is brought in. It isn't like a naturally occurring thing. So, that's the problem is that he wants to do things like it's better beach sand. He's looking for better handicap accessibility. He's looking for all kinds of upgrades, but he has to work it within a confined capital budget.
Right, exactly. Yeah, he's a former mayor of Revere, so he knows all about constituent services. This is just on a bigger scale.
Yeah, he's very sensitive to that, actually. He's very sensitive to constituent services, and he understands the logistics. So I always say that, like, running a big city, but it's not a city. You're running a giant network of infrastructure that people do depend on and utilize. And he gets the politics of this because, as a mayor, he's dealt with many municipal officials, and there's some different dynamics that are going on in different communities. And they were very happy keeping in the city, spend 2 hours walking and talking and showing you what things are. And something, for example, like Frenchburg Parkway near the Varanasi School, to be looking at new sidewalks. Sometimes this summertime, they're going to start the process of sidewalk replacement. So that's a plus. And we just got an inventory recently from DCR regarding streetlights that are down and what the problems there are, like either they're missing or there's a conduit problem, whatever. So, the fact they're moving forward in the inventory, that's a good sign that they can move forward on systematically deciding, where to prioritize replacing which streetlights first. Obviously, I like in the darker section then first, personally speaking. I would like it if you could get the darker sections first and work its way to the not as dark sections. But I mean, I actually took a video. Me and my buddy Joe, got in his car and just put my phone camera up against the windshield as we drove down and drove back at like 10 o'clock at night to show the commissioner exactly how dark it was. So now that he got a personal view of it, he understands the concerns I have. And the delegation's going to continue to keep working with the commissioner. And we're very respectful of the commissioner's challenges, not just in Quincy, but statewide. And we'll just keep working on it. I'm just happy that that they listen to our concerns and they're taking it seriously. And we respect that he's got a lot of balancing work he's got to do.
Yeah, you're talking all about the mayor's suggestion for the city to take over some of the like the Wollaston Beach area for the Squatting Point Park, the places like that.
Well, the mayor never told him,
Oh,
so.
okay. Well, he told everybody else. He really should tell him too.
Yeah, the commissioner was rather surprised to hear that. He did actually did his news article search before regarding what was going on down here before he came down. We live in a world where you can just start to Google, right? You just kind of go on online search to before you
Sure.
do some quick reading about what's happening in bits and pieces. I do that too before I visit a locale. I'm like, okay, let's look at the news feed and see what I can find what's going on there so I have some sense of what's going on.
Yeah.
So, I brought that to his attention a while back and we brought it to his attention again. And in case you're wondering, it does require almost active legislature to transfer properties because it's all considered environmentally sensitive land. But one of the things you may not be aware of is the fact that there's under Queen Shore Drive, actually under the sidewalk in Wilson Beach, there's about a 6-foot MWRA sewer pipeline that goes to Nut Island. That's an MWRA easement. And people who live across along Queen Shore Drive on Wilson Beach. There's easements ranging from, half a foot to like many feet that residents encroached on DCR property. So they have individual easement agreements across all that. Squatting Point Park has an easement agreement with National Grid. Our secondary power conduit actually comes underneath Squatting Point Park. One of the reasons Squatting Point Park had its initial renovations because it's part of mitigation with the National Grid. I was around for that like 25 years ago.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that.
I talked about the street lights already, and you guys all know about the underground conduit as well, which is actually another easement of National Grid in DCR. But I mean, if the mayor thinks they can take, Frenchburg Parkway and suddenly can have street lights up, well, no, that isn't how that works. And of course, we have a lot of capital money in all of this. I mean, between cash and bonds, the continuation of bonds, I mean, the state taxpayer, pays for the debt collectively on these properties. And the shared jurisdiction, including overtime patrols by the state. So, Bruce and I every year get money in the state budget for increased overtime patrols during the summer months to tune of $95,000, if I remember correctly. So they have increased patrols on overtime down Crenshaw Drive and Frenchburg Parkway when particularly the warmer months hit. So because the fiscal year is in July, there's enough money for the beginning of the season and half the season, as you can kind of figure out. So money's divvied up between the two halves of the fiscal, each side of the fiscal year. So, which helps out on security and which helps out on reducing the, hot night problems, so to speak. When people have really hot, things can get kind of itchy. So state troopers are out there in larger force, and that's paid by overtime money that Bruce and I get. So, and the state has a first jurisdiction, but the city police also has jurisdiction as well. You may have seen city police respond to emergency on Glacier Drive, their concurrent jurisdiction, but first chance jurisdiction is the state. So it's very involved actually with the DCR properties. It's not as simple as saying, give us, some land beach, There's a lot of debt in there. There's a whole ton of different easements as you can tell. The state pays security, state police security for those locales. Yeah, so if the taxpayer wants to pick up tens of millions of dollars in new costs, I mean, definitely go ahead and tell that to your counselors. That's a great idea. But I have no interest in saying that, no, you can have this for free. From a state tax dollar standpoint, there is state tax dollar investment.
Interesting. It looks like the T is on track, pardon the pun, to meet the goal of reducing or eliminating all the slow zones by the end of the year.
Yeah, it looks like they're going to make it. I've realized there have been some concerns of hang-ups during certain sections of the track, which that's not how to increase the speed on the trains. You don't know till you do it, because you don't. And it's create, they're now looking at some of the structural integrity of the track to make sure the increased speeds does not cause a problem. No one wants to derailment under any circumstances. So I've saw I actually didn't see it yet, but I mean I'm aware there's a Globe article that kind of beats up the tea a little bit about the slow zones and the speed ups on the rail system and how that the speed up has been slowed down a little bit as they do the track reevaluations. But the T during the red line portion, I can't speak for the other lines, did a very systematic approach where they like checked over and over again the integrity of the work done, especially integrity of the track itself. So we'll see how this plays out. I'm hoping that between the settling, everything settles well. On the new work, and then as the speed of the train goes up, they can safely go at higher speeds. I'll cross my fingers here, but obviously the goal is not just getting you on a timely travel, but we don't want you to be hurt as a result of said time of travel.
Obviously, safety has got to be number one.
Yeah. Train moving at 45 miles an hour at high speeds on a rail, and something happens on that rail. I mean, it's beyond horrific.
The next big challenge, obviously, will be the T budget, right?
Yeah, the T Advisory Board did come see me in actually in my office for a meeting about this, the executive director of the board, and we had a chat about this. And this is something not new to us in the legislature. We've been aware for many years of the fiscal cliff. Combination of increased ridership, fare increases, the state tax dollars supplementing the T, and certain budget gaps over decades now has able to keep them going. But there's a lot of new factors this time out that wasn't there, namely work from home. So in certain routes, they are back to maximum capacity. Certain other routes are not. And one of the problems I've always said about the T is that before COVID, when they had maximum usage during the time of day you expect maximum usage, you can't put any more people in a train. You can't put more people on a train or a bus. You're not making any more money. Right? There is a customer cap. It's just the nature of it. You can only fit so much inside a car, or you can fit so much inside the bus. How much more money can you squeeze? You got nobody more and more space to put people into it, right? So now it's kind of a quirky issue regarding inconsistency of work schedules around the state. It's not the same everywhere. And this impacts commuter rail travel too. So therefore, weekday commuter rail travel is not as robust as it was prior to COVID. The weekends is better, but the weekends also discount rate to get people to come and use services in Boston, the greater Boston area. So this is problematic in the sense that people's work patterns have changed, which changes how the T's customers utilize them. So I don't have an answer yet how we're going to solve this, but the fiscal cliff is finally here. The Fed money that was kind of floating them by during COVID's been exhausted. And they had a hiring problem. You guys are aware that you don't need to call a friend to get your job anymore. There are so many vacancies that even there is those days are dead of the whole, oh, you can quit a job. That's gone. The supply, the T is plenty of slots. But I mean, we also don't want to downsize their staff because they were already downsized before the budget crisis started, which kind of flagged off some of the budget problems. But now they're trying to come back to better operations. That means more people. I don't know how we're going to address this next year. I'm sure the new transportation chair in the House, because we don't have a transportation chair because Bill Strauss has retired.
Oh, yeah, right.
We'll probably have the first one to try to look at an issue, but I am acutely aware of the size of the
Do you
hole.
think the millionaires revenue from the millionaires tax can help?
That is a solution. Transportation is what it uses for the millionaire's tax. I prefer to see the millionaire's tax as found money, though treated as baseline money in the budget. And secondly, if it's going to do that for the T, the regional transports want to do something too. Regional transport agencies around the state is going to want a piece of the budget too. But once
Sure.
you start doing that, it becomes part of their baseline budget, and it retarded to treat it like found money.
Well, because it's not stable, right?
That's the reason. I mean, I have a whole mentality about found money in government, is that if it's an unstable source, meaning that it's, we don't know what the actual steady number is going to look like about spending time waiting it out, because you have to give it years to see real numbers and you can start making projections off of that. We
Right.
should do it like found money. It's like we did with casino money. Casino money was a bunch of different trust funds, so we treat it like found money.
Right. Yep. So you could use it for special projects, maybe, but not for a baseline budget.
That's exactly it. That's a big question for me, as well as the people above me in the food chain, is that if we start tackling regional transport agencies, as well as the MBTA in terms of permanent budget fix, and we use something that we're not entirely clear but long-term steadiness of that revenue stream. It doesn't have to be the same every year, folks. It just needs to have some predictability. It may go up, it may go down, but we have some idea what the pattern is going to look like. You can budget accordingly. Right. This is not a job where you expect a steady growth or
Right.
stagnation. Surprise, tax revenue goes up and down. So, we try to anticipate based on historical pattern how it's going to work. And then you had COVID, which there is no historical pattern. It just throws a whole thing out of whack. So then, we've had, so-called four good years of revenue, but it's kind of not normal, right? It is a normal economic cycle. So, the T, as you just heard me talk earlier, is working in a new type of economy that none of us anticipate. And that's kind of the situation we're in.
How do you feel about cannabis cafes, Tacky?
I'm surprised they made any proposals in the commission, given how screwed up that commission is.
Oh yeah, there is
For those
that.
who are not aware, the Cannabis Control Commission still doesn't have an executive director, and
That's correct.
they're an acting chair. There's a whole lot of question marks. I think you're going to find more news articles coming up about the operations of it. I remember we were talking about earlier, the Inspector General found like $2 million in like missing cash checks or whatever. They were missing like
Oh,
$2 million.
yeah, yes.
The last thing these guys should be doing is creating new public policies on anything. Well, they can't get their internal house in order. So I am very shocked about even them suggesting the idea of cannabis for cafes. They should be working on their internal problems. So we have confidence that they're actually doing the job safeguarding the public, as well as accountability for the cannabis industry, much less proposing new ideas.
Yeah, I have to wonder if it's not a deflection tactic to steer attention away from their internal mistrust.
I'm very troubled by this. And again, it's also an acting chair and no executive director. Executive director actually made an offer to and backed out. So
That's right.
they had like actually had one in the pipe. And after the decision was made who they wanted, this individual got out, just realized what the individual was trying to get into. So I'm not pleased necessarily about the idea of. I'm just pleased about the commission's operations. Now, on cannabis cafes and other things like that, I mean, whether we like it or not, you can smell people smoking pot down the street on Fennel Street at the basketball courts. I mean, it's not my favorite odor by any stretch of imagination. But I mean, now allowing a controlled product into in the less controlled environment, right? And that's the cafe concept. If you're going to allow, cafes to sell cannabis products like you would other products, and what kind of controls you're going to have in there regarding controlled substance. And this is, again, back to the enforcement problem of the Cannabis Commission. If you
Right.
have a dysfunctional commission, you're going to actually like have people comply regarding utilization of a product that is a controlled substance. And this is what troubles me. So public consumption of cannabis is out there. I'm not going to pretend it isn't. I think you all know it is. But you have designated areas allowed not just for consumption, but also selling of product on premise. Well, okay, how does that work? It's not like a bring your own. It's like it's not going to be a bring your own. It sounds like the scenarios they're going to sell to you at cafes.
Yeah, that's what I ascertained as well. And there was a suggestion that these places must sell food along with the other products.
Well, it's intriguing, right? I mean, we tie these licenses to the number of alcohol licenses you have available, right? So there's a ratio here of available alcohol licenses. This is a controlled substance. It does have a mind-altering effect. It doesn't affect everyone the same way, too. Everyone's different. So, you're going to allow an entity a license to sell these products, but should we tie it to like alcohol or not, right? I mean, it's a license. The Keno licenses, after the initial insanity of just putting them everywhere, Keno licenses after that initial like dumbness of just putting them everywhere, I'll say it straight up, eventually found themselves to just being in bars.
Right. And it's worked.
It's worked
Yeah.
because it's a contained location of rapid gambling, right? If you have, there is no like tip training for cannabis, right?
That's exactly what I was going to bring up. Yep.
So that's why I'm like looking at the commissioners. You should all be doing nothing, because as the guy who does regulatory stuff on a lot of things as the chair of this committee, alcohol is one of the areas that I have some familiarity regarding controlled substance oversight. And there's a lot of liabilities associated with alcohol. This is a state we can sue for over-serving. You can demonstrate the over-serving caused someone else to be injured. I mean, it's a pretty high bar, folks. It isn't like just a willy-nilly simple lawsuit, but it is feasible to do. What do you do in the case of someone that's may have caused injury to others because they get sleepy and just fall over or something, right? I mean, I do understand that it has different effects than alcohol, but those different effects still could result in a negative situation where potentially someone could get hurt.
Yep, they're debilitating just as much as alcohol for sure, just maybe in a different way, but still can cause injury, operating machinery such as a vehicle, or like you say, just walking down the sidewalk.
And everybody's different, right? It doesn't affect everyone the same way, too. So, again, I mean, if I hand you some edibles, cannabis edibles, I mean, now what, right? Where's the control from there? Is it only for adult-only establishments, or is it something you do with, mixed use, like trouble things like movie theaters, right?
Right, a lot of questions. Yep.
A lot of questions, right? And you can have alcohol at Showcase Cinemas and AMCs if they have an alcohol license. But I mean, there's a liability that the movie theater, shares with the with whomever's serving the alcohol regarding, proper tip training and all that stuff. There is none of that in, cannabis in terms of like serving you in a recreational setting like a movie theater or cafe.
Right, no, it's kind of the Wild West, right, exactly.
Yeah. So, I mean, and there's also the medical study problems. I mean, if you start looking online now, because cannabis has been legalized either just medically or fully for recreational use, there's slowly but steadily no medical studies about the impact of cannabis on people. Again, I still understand why anybody smokes to put burning things into your lungs or vapes, which is putting water into your lungs. I just don't understand why people think that's good. But I mean, burning ash into your lungs, I don't care if it's a cigarette or cannabis, it's really bad. I mean, it's not like you stick your head over a barbecue just inhaling for kicks. So, but I mean, it does lung damage over time. Well, yeah, short-term lung damage, if it doesn't. Again, it's you look at these studies coming out, and I'm not saying it's doom and gloom, but there are negative impacts associated with extended use. And again, but it's not the same for everyone, right? And
Right.
this is the problem of this industry, is that it's going to take more time as more people utilize it, more studies are done, the medical impacts will be more apparent, then we have some better idea of what it means to different folks, the use of cannabis. But the medical studies are going to take probably another few years or more years as it comes out, whether or not it rises to a level where the FDA needs to do something because right now at the federal level it's banned, it's illegal. But I mean, if the feds want to get their hands on this, they may have to make that hard decision to legalize cannabis for no for the exclusive purpose of give FDA control regarding what is a safe and safe unsafe and safe product on a national level.
Right, yeah.
Right now it's state by state, and you're
Yes.
expecting the state to, be the FDA for cannabis. Well, that's why I have the Cannabis Control Commission. Right. And I know there's THC drinks, but I'm not entirely clear as to what the effects are. It's not something I partake in. Also, I got more food allergies that makes my life complicated. But the what the THC effects on these, you can buy, what are its effects on individuals? Is sufficient enough in there to do an impact on your system? And I don't have an answer for it because people give me different answers regarding the amount per milligram has like different impacts.
The answer is it depends, right? Depends on a lot of things. Your own metabolism, the amount, the timing, and a lot of things, yeah.
If it's an edible, do you have a full stomach before you eat it? I mean,
Right.
yeah, I don't have an easy answer for you guys, and I wish I did, but I don't. And people who say they have all the answers probably don't either, because again, it's a case by case basis, and the medical system is still out there waiting for us to tell. And again, let's fall back on a national. It's gonna, if cannabis recreational use becomes much more prevalent in more states, at some stage we need a national standard regarding the safety of the matter, because right now it's up to each individual standards on regulations, and it's a the regulatory agency it does that, but it should be a DPH function, to a food agricultural function each state to try to figure out, what is the standards should be allowed. But you have this, on top of that, you have the entity that regulates the licensing, which is different. It's not like alcohol, where there's an AFT. Alcohol oversight has been something that's been dealt with since the colonial era. So it's kind of one of those new uncharted territories.
Right. I know we're at the end of the hour, Tacky, so here's where you let folks know how to get a hold of you.
Sure. 617-722-2370. 617-722-2370. It's the phone number. We're in room 42 in the State House. As you can tell, I'm here. So we are staffed. Tacky.chan at emmahouse.gov, tacky.chan at emmahouse.gov is the email here. We have State Representative Tacky Chan on Facebook. You can see pictures of me doing stuff. Again, exit Tacky Chan. So we do have the Twitter account still, and we have tackychat.org, which is our resource page, which people actually do use that portal, as we discovered, to reach out, as well as malegislature.gov. Definitely visit the state legislative website. Very useful. You don't actually need me, as I say over and over again, for finding reference material. It's all at your fingertips. And of course, Joe and I will try to be educational and entertaining, hopefully at the same time every week or 2 weeks, as we head into this holiday season, and definitely catch Joe in the morning and his Quincy AM show, which is a quick 10-minute podcast.
All right, and we know it's the holidays because you have your Christmas light tie on.
Yes, I do have a small number of Christmas ties, and today's the Looney Tune ties with the various Looney Tune characters with Christmas lights. So
Very
you'll see this a couple more times. I only wear it, for a very limited edition.
That's
It's like your ugly sweaters. They only show
right.
up.
Back in the closet till next year.
Absolutely.
Thanks, Jackie.
Thank you, Joe. Let's talk to you soon.